From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a conversation with community activist and protest organizer Khalil Coleman. Then we learn about this year's virtual Milwaukee Short Film Festival, featuring best of programming.
We contacted them, reached out to all the filmmakers, and they were readily happy to help us and put this together and have their work screened again.
Plus, we hear from Milwaukee's Poet Laureate about performing and connecting with people during a pandemic.
Because outside of creating stuff, we still are partners and parents and neighbors and, you know, we're still our citizens also trying to figure this out.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The recent protests and demonstrations for racial justice and police accountability are undoubtedly some of the defining moments of this era. For some, this summer was a breaking point. But for others, like Khalil Coleman, it was the next step of a movement that's been building for years. Coleman is a local community activist and protest organizer, whose work has been crucial to the demonstrations here in Milwaukee. He was profiled in an article for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, alongside fellow protest leaders Frank Nitti and Vaughn Mays. Khalil Coleman joins me to talk about his work, this movement, and the future of these demonstrations. Khalil, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for the invite.
So much has happened over this summer and even these last few weeks, so I feel like it's pretty important to ask this. How are you doing right now? How are you feeling?
I'm doing great, actually. Obviously, some ups and downs and things, you know, in terms of, you know, justice and whatnot, but as far as, you know, my mental, you know, my physical, my spiritual level, I am blessed. I'm doing great.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I know, especially the last month or so has been really emotionally taxing for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Much of this movement has recently shifted to Kenosha, Wisconsin. How have you been involved in the protests there?
You know, we started off our first 3 days out there in Kenosha. You know, very intense environment, of course. You know, a lot of things happening. I believe it was our second or third day during the day of the shooting that occurred. And, you know, we was listening to the radars, the scanners and things of that nature. And, you know, just, you know, having a little intel with some of the groups that was interning to Kenosha. And, you know, we just started getting updates of, like, these white supremacist groups were coming in to attack peaceful protesters. You know, they was coming looking to harm individuals and things of that nature. You know, we've been protesting across Wisconsin over the past 100 days. You know, and I remember just kind of being down there and, you know, we ended up parking, you know, at a particular intersection and, you know, probably not even within 2-3 hours of us being there, we got calls that our tires were slashed, that the police was looking to push protesters to a particular designated area, and they were going to step back and allow these white supremacist groups to, you know, something to the nature of, like, do what they do. So, you know, we was hearing all of this information, pretty much people calling us, telling us, be careful down there, you know, you guys are being targeted, et cetera, et cetera. And when the shooting occurred, it actually occurred maybe about like 3 or 4 blocks from where we were from. So all of this stuff was going on at the same time of all of our tires being slashed, or at least over 13 vehicles, I believe, experienced tire slash. So not all of them per se, but so we were stuck in the middle of Kenosha with the city being on lockdown, gas stations being closed, no tolls. coming into the city to help anybody out. People were forced to drive their cars on flats out of Kenosha to a more safer county. So it's been extremely intense, you know, and knowing one of the individuals who was shot was a medic since day one of the protest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You know, this is a guy who has put himself on the line multiple times when police were shooting people with rubber bullets, throwing tear gas during a time when real gunfire and things were being exchanged. These were individuals who were putting their selves on the line, running in the middle of chaos and pulling people to rescue, and to find out that, you know, this was one of the individuals who was a victim in this shooting. It was very emotional for people. So it's been crazy these last 100 days, to say the least.
Yeah, of course. Now, you've been involved with a lot of the behind-the-scenes work, making these demonstrations happen, making things flow more smoothly. What has that experience been like, especially since there's been so much that has happened, as you mentioned, over the last 100 days or so?
It's been humbling, you know, just to, you know, walk alongside with some of these individuals, you know, just phenomenal people, you know, educators, social workers, artists, you know, corporate people in high places and, you know, on the front line and behind the scenes who just support the work that the people in the revolution have been participating in and been able to make happen. It's just been a humbling experience. You know, for so many great people to come together into a line with a vision. And of course, you know, since day one and, you know, looking at 103 days, of course, the numbers aren't as strong. But I think the support from the community, you know, whether we go in Milwaukee, whether we go in Tulsa, it's still really heavy. You know, people want to see these demonstrations happen. People want to see law changes. People want to see a change in community culture, you know, where black and white and black and brown and white people can coexist, you know, in a community and not be treated unjust. So, you know, it has been a lot of work and a lot of people have really stepped up and have helped this revolution grow and progress over the 100 days.
Yeah, of course, you know, you're mentioning this is a movement that has not only been here in Milwaukee and also in Kenosha, but also in Wauwatosa, and a number of the members of your group actually went to D.C. What was that like? I know that you were back here in Milwaukee for this, but what was that experience like setting that up?
Yeah, you know, we have one of our core organizers, you know, Mariah Smith, pretty much leading the D.C. trip. You know, we were able to get sponsors. I believe about 30 so people, you know, went on the trip or so. And for a lot of them, it was their first time, you know, going to D.C., you know, being able to go to the White House, you know, especially with so much political tension going on right now with you know, evolving around presidency and just a lot of social issues right now. You know, it was a great experience to be able to have people stay back and keep the revolution alive and thriving for these 100 and something days and have people out there in D.C. keeping the message alive, bring it to the forefront, issues of Wisconsin, issues of Milwaukee. So it was just great to see the duo, you know, still continue to, you know, take these concerns and their experiences and expand them and have our people come back from D.C., you know, with more fire, more insight, and just a better understanding of how this thing connects on a national level. I think that was probably the most important part of the D.C. trip.
Yeah, to give it some of that national view. You know, as you've said, this is a movement that has led to some real change. When you look at the last months, what are the things that you're most proud of that you've been able to accomplish through this movement?
You know, on our 100th day, we finally released our demands. I think that was a really, really big accomplishment for us, you know, to be able to go through our first, you know, 99 days of experience, you know, really seeing what the issue were, really listening to the people in terms of, their ability to be able to articulate what it is that needed to be done in the system, you know, and being able to have that pressure and that demand in the street while we're protesting, you know, shutting things down, making that impact, you know, to be able to supply these demands with that. You know, we also been able to get Joseph Mensah suspended, the police officer out in Wauwatosa who killed 3 individuals within the 5-year span. We was able to get the officer who killed Mattioli, who killed Joel Acevedo. You know, charges are pending against him in the strangulation of Joel. We were able to fire the chief from Milwaukee Police Department with the support of the Fire and Police Commission, just with their lack of transparency and urgency in regarding a lot of these matters, you know, and just the lack of leadership in regards to MPD, you know. So that was a big thing. You know, places like Cudahy, you know, introduced legislation such as racism is a public health crisis. You know, that was introduced out there in Cudahy. Legislation was introduced into the Common Council of Milwaukee, the I Can't Breathe legislation by Malele Cox. Not really sure where that's at in the legislation, but these are the type of things that are occurring because of the protests. You know, in Wauwatosa, we was able to ban no knock warrants and no chokeholds by any law enforcement within the district of Wauwatosa. You know, we established an ad hoc committee in Wauwatosa that pretty much takes these recommendations directly to the Common Council for voting purposes and decision making. So all of this has occurred within the first 100 days of protests. And it's been some great challenges, but some great success to go along with them.
Now, of course, the movement isn't over by any stretch of the imagination. I've heard that some people want to go for at least 200 days. What do you see as kind of the end of this movement? And I guess the other question is, do you see an end?
You know, I've been in a lot of protests throughout the years out here in Milwaukee. You know, I think my first jump was like the murder of Darius Simmons, who was killed in front of his house after John Spooner, the murderer of Darius Simmons, the 13-year-old boy. John Spooner spoke with Bob Donovan, former alderman. And pretty much Bob Donovan, I remember how the investigation went. Bob Donovan told him to do what he had to do. And John Spooner ended up going home after meeting with him, and he killed the 13-year-old boy in front of his parents. And that's really what sparked me and leading a lot of the protests out here in Milwaukee. And then it led to Derek Williams, who was murdered. They broke his neck bone and threw him in the backseat of a police car, and he suffocated. And I remember marching in the streets for a whole year for Derek Williams. And then we ended up connecting with Michael Bell, and, you know, we passed the bail law with the outside investigation with police officers. And then I remember Dontre Hamilton died, and for 4 months the family cried in the park with no answer from the mayor, from the chief. And then we ended up leading the Dontre Hamilton rallies, and, you know, now here we are. And I remember taking a break after that and then kind of seeing all of the other stuff transpiring around the country. You know, hearing about George Floyd just recently, and it just opened up a lot of wounds. And, you know, to kind of answer your question about like this, and I think all of it kind of builds up one addition on top of the other. The evolution of each one of these things occurring, you know, is what continues to build on what the next phase look like. So, you know, whether we're done, and I don't think that 200 days is like our goal of like being done, you know, that kind of came out of us marching on a regular, and then, you know, us learning a little history about the Milwaukee housing marches and learning that they marched for 200 days. And then it became a thing like, okay, you know, for revolution, like, you know, we can do this. And a lot of people just kind of like want to see us, you know, make that history. But I don't think that's the goal of the end of the protest. I think people really want to see laws change. People really want to see police be held accountable, you know, when they break the law, when they break policies and procedures, to not allow them to be on paid relief, right? You know, to allow police officers to go through due process. Like, if I kill, I'm going to court. You know what I'm saying? I got to face my jury. Police officers should do the same thing. You know, when they murder, it shouldn't be exempt, investigations, you know, and I think that's what people want to see. People want to see police officers be judged by a jury of their peers, just like every other person would too.
Yeah. So as you look to the future, what are your biggest priorities in at least the immediate future? What do you want to see happen?
You know, in the immediate future, you know, we want to see, of course, Joseph Vincent fired. You know, he shouldn't be a police officer. You know, I mean, you know, we feel there's like some real issues for one cop to kill three people within a 5-year span, right? And if he follows every policy, then that's a problem too. Because if I kill three people within 5 years and this is a policy for policing for me to do, I think all of these things are questionable right now, right? Is it the individual or is it the system that needs to be held accountable? And in some cases, it's both, right? Because we have individuals who are acting as judge, jury, and executioners because they can, because the system allows them to. That's what I want to see, like me personally. You know, I want to see police officers go to jail, you know, when they break the law, you know, just like my brothers and my sisters would in my community. I want to see me and my children and my brothers and sisters in my community live where police officers are accountable to the community that they serve, you know, and when police officers break laws and policies and procedures, that they're held accountable in the community that they serve. That's what I want to see happen.
All right. Well, Khalil, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Khalil Coleman is a local community activist and protest organizer. Coleman was profiled in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine alongside activists Frank Nitti and Vaughn Mays. We'll take a short break now, then learn about some changes made to the 22nd annual Milwaukee Short Film Festival. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Although some movie theater chains are starting to reopen their doors, yet another Milwaukee Film Festival decided to move to a virtual platform this year. The Milwaukee Short Film Festival usually takes place over 2 days at the Fox Bay Cinema. But since the coronavirus pandemic hit during the festival's submission period, organizers decided they had to change course. So the 22nd annual Milwaukee Short Film Festival is now online for everyone to access, and it will be showing a selection of their best of picks from the past 5 years. To tell us more, the festival's director, Ross Bigley, joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
So there's a lot of planning that goes into the Short Film Festival, of course, particularly with film submissions. So when did you realize you had to change course for the 2020 Milwaukee Short Film Festival?
Well, our submission process is pretty long. We are normally started around August and go till June. And our early bird deadline really isn't where we get our biggest haul. We have an extended version of that just so people can take advantage of the lower rates, but they never really do. Our regular deadline is where we get most of our films. And when COVID hit was when our regular deadline submission period was going on, and we saw that film stop coming in around the world and across America. And I was like, okay, this could be a little bit of a concern. And I decided to wait it to see a couple of weeks, see what's going on and seeing how people were dealing with COVID. And we decided that it was best to postpone an in-person live event. The thing that kind of drove us to that was Irish Fest, which is a few weeks before us, canceled early on. And we were thinking that, well, that's a sign that we should not have an in-person one, because I think probably mid-March, everyone was kind of wondering when things would get back to normal, and we didn't know if it'd be fine in the fall or not. And clearly it still isn't. So I think we made the right choice at that time.
Right. And so for all of the films that you did get submitted for this year's festival, what's the plan for them in the future?
Well, what we're doing is we do have films submitted. We contacted all those filmmakers, and those films are going to be on hold for next season. We've extended the deadlines to next year. And basically, our regular deadline is going to be probably around, I think it's April 30th, and then the final deadline is June 1st. So people have all this time to submit. We have started getting films back in again. So we're confident we'll have new selections for next year, and we'll probably have enough to put together a good program too.
Well, and for this year's program, it's still a good one. How did you pick the best of featured in this year's festival? There's 21 films total, and you basically looked back on the last 5 years of all the films you've had.
Well, what we did was I contacted my content manager to see what films we had still available on our hard drives. And we had like a 5 year period of films. And that's kind of mostly when people started sending digital files anyway, so it matched up timeline wise, where people weren't sending in discs anymore or anything. They were sending digital files to us. And we went through the lineup for the past 5 years and started looking at the award-winning films to make it a best of. And there's a few films in there that aren't award winners, but they were clearly audience favorites too. They got pretty high marks from, you know, judges anyway too. So we contacted them, reached out to all the filmmakers, and they were readily happy to help us and put this together and have their work screened again.
Well, and I suppose, do you feel as if it helps because you built such a community around the Film Fest and the filmmakers that have been a part of it and its overall impact?
Yeah, we have an excellent relationship with our past filmmakers, and many of them have gone on to do great things, and they were more than happy to help us. Filmmakers even come back to our festival year after year to resubmit films, and it's good to having a relationship like that with our filmmakers.
So how have you and your fellow filmmakers been impacted overall by the pandemic? I mean, we've seen massive studio budgeted films maybe go to digital or push off their releases, but the impact is far greater for independent film.
Yeah. There has been filming in the area. I've heard from friends that they've done some things social distancing wise. A lot of times with lower budget fare, you don't have the money to quarantine cast and crew in a hotel for 2 weeks. You know, many people have day jobs or a life. So you have to be really careful. So there's a great concern in that. And we have seen things kind of like start up, but I think my preference is I would always prefer to see something in a theater. I'm more than happy to wait, you know, to see something along the lines of a big event film in a theater with a bunch of people. I'm more than happy to wait. But, you know, we could come to a point where content becomes more scarce too, where all the stuff that these streaming sites have banked start depleting a little bit too.
For you and me, I think we'd both agree that seeing things in the theater is one of our favorite things to do.
Yeah.
And of course, that was a big part of this community as well, was, you know, you'd have this festival at the Fox Bay Theater in Whitefish Bay over a couple of days, and there's that community building aspect. And even though it's virtual, do you feel there's still some positive to what you had to do to change the format for this year?
We had to change the format because we had no choice. Mainly because of how COVID affected us. But, you know, the Fox Bay is a great venue. We love being there. They're open, they are screening movies, and they have found a way to supplement their income by building a takeout service with their full menu as well. So they're able to stay afloat, and we've been sharing their stuff on social media to make sure people can order food from them as well, too, to help them out. And we're doing things with our sponsors, too, that, you know, make people aware that they're still open. You know, they have businesses to run, and they're trying to pay a staff and everything, too. So we're, you know, we share things on social media of our sponsors, and we'll have some stuff at the festival, too, pertaining to our sponsors.
One of the unique aspects of the Milwaukee Short Film Festival is your Voices Heard program, which still remains the only program in the city that puts the spotlight on local filmmakers of color. So among Voices Heard and all the content over the past 5 years, what are some of the best picks for yourself that either people can revisit or even watch for the first time? Because this is available for everyone.
Yeah, well, you've been kind enough to judge our festival a couple of years, so you've probably seen some of the films that we'll be showing at this best of. And Voices Heard is a part of it. We sprinkle those films throughout the lineup there. And Control is one of my favorites that we have. It's by Allison Becker and Kimmy Gatewood. It's a really strong film. The Homecoming by Paulina Bugambi is really good too. That was a Voices Heard best winner. And it's sort of based on her family a little bit too. We have Ready to Go by Linda Rice. We love that film. And it's interesting that she began her career in the industry as a property master, working on various films and TV shows and all that. And this is her first directorial feature. She sent us a new film, Lancaster Park, which we are going to show next year. We have Home Alone, an animated film by Aaron Johnson, who works at Plum Media, about the suicides that take place or people contemplating suicide on the Home Bridge. It's a very powerful film. We have Hero in Limbo by Van Campbell. It's about drug addiction, how that kind of takes hold of your life and kind of tempers your vision of the world a little bit. So there's a lot of really good, strong films in this festival.
Definitely, and a few of those you mentioned really stick out to me just from watching them quite a while back, and I'm sure other people will enjoy it, whether it's revisiting or the first time watching them. So, Ross, thanks so much for sharing your work.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Ross Bigley is the director of the Milwaukee Short Film Festival. This year, the event is virtual with best of screenings on September 11th and 12th. Bigley joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. After the break, we'll hear from Milwaukee's Poet Laureate about what it's been like trying to hold events, collaborate, and perform during the pandemic. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Getting wrapped up in a spoken word performance or feeling part of an artistic experience looks and sounds a lot different since the pandemic closed venues. Many artists rely on creating a connection with people in exchange for making a living. Now, performers have had to adapt to earning that living through the exchange of connection and creative expression in a digital space. Lake Effect recently launched a new series called Pandemic Performers, where we're highlighting some of the work coming from Milwaukee artists, performers, and venues at a time when many of us are still isolated. Dasha Kelly Hamilton is Milwaukee's Poet Laureate. She's a writer, performer, and a creative change agent. She often holds workshops and collaborates with other artists in the community, and even opened a new venue in October of last year. Hamilton spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how she's adapted to sharing her work and facilitating conversations online.
So what has the pandemic been like for you as an artist, a performer, and a creative change agent?
It's been at the first part of it, it felt like a reckoning of, oh my goodness, why didn't I become an accountant? And then very quickly, I didn't become an accountant because this is purpose. You know, my work is purpose driven. That's what I'm made of. So it was a lot of settling in. I've been describing it as taking care of my inners, I-N-N-E-R-S. So it's reflection and staying in touch with folks and thinking about my craft and what projects, what writing can I do, do I want to do? And obviously there are the things that initially that felt that they'd been taken away, from gigs and conferences and performances and such. So as a writer, I just need my laptop or a journal. And I've been able to spend time with a manuscript that I've been tinkering at for a while. So now it's a much more robust writing schedule pouring into that. As far as performances go, as the world has moved into virtual space and become more, and not just resigned to Zoom, but also really creative in how to do streaming. Done some programs of my own. I've been a part of some readings. I've hosted and curated different discussions. And so that's been, it's been exciting, actually. There are some that didn't work. Not that they didn't work, but they were definitely a replacement for being together. And then there are some that were actually much more robust as a virtual experience. One, because now I'm able to actually have the artist on the screen that I wouldn't have been able to afford to bring into town from Beirut or from Philly. So it's been an expansion in a lot of ways too of what's possible. And being reminded it's always been possible. Zoom and Skype and Google Meet didn't just show up. We're turning to them in a new way. We are going to have shows again. There are going to be conferences again. There are going to be gatherings. They'll be different, but they'll happen. In this phase of the experience as an artist, I'm giving myself, thinking big. I'll always think big, but moving forward, just continuing to plan forward. So I have a tour that starting to book dates. So all is not lost as much as it felt that way at the outset.
Community is such a large part of art, of creating it, is sharing it. How has your relationship to the community of artists changed?
You know, we have a unique position in that as artists, as creatives, we're making our own work, right? So I have a poem that I created about, you know, I said, hey, so listen. I know right now it feels like, what have you done to your life? Like I said at the beginning, why didn't I go into accounting? Why didn't you do these other things? Because this is the moment that the naysayer cousin, this is the moment that the doubtful parent, this is the moment of skepticism where you can feel like everything that you poured, all that you poured into this work, this craft, this journey has been for naught. It has not. That is not what's happened. Now, about that rainy day fund, that was true. That was a bit of advice that across the board, you know, depending on how robust your career is, whether you do that or not, whether you have those business practices or not, as an independent contractor, as a creative, as an artist, but this choice that you've made for your time and your talent and your purpose in your life, no. And you see the different reports popping up, how people who are taking these art classes and painting classes and listening to music and watching all of the verses battle on Instagram and, you know, reading more and figuring out how to bake sourdough bread. These creative endeavors are keeping this planet alive and sane and still human. So to that end, you know, the watching folks who are still able to create, who are still creating, and a lot of artists aren't, it's a draining toll, worrying, and it just feels a little bit different. So in those cases, it's having, you know, taking the time, you know, have a lot of art, we check in on each other. Hey, how are you doing? How are you holding up? Hey, what are you working on? Hey, what's a goofy thing that you're watching? Because outside of creating stuff, we still are partners and parents and neighbors, and, you know, we're still our citizens also trying to figure this out.
How has your work, your writing, been influenced by this pandemic?
It's been impacted more so by what I'm able now to give attention. So, for example, this manuscript, for me to write fiction is a different, like, it feels like a different cellular experience than writing a poem. So writing a poem, I could work on a poem on the, you know, in the margin of a meeting agenda, and still be in space with other folks. Because they're, it's a collection of images and ideas that I sculpt together. Fiction, I need to be focused. You know, it's to the exclusion of stuff and people, and it's not going to be productive in 20, 30 minute chunks. And I always haven't had that time. And even when I had the time, set aside my writing time, okay, well, rub your hands together. Okay, it's fiction time. But as a writer, you know, seldom do I just sit down and just start banging out. You know, I can and I do, and those are usually the first 200 words that get tossed. So you're cutting out the pipe. So the process of committing to fiction, I have in an unrushed way, able to really fall into that work. So it's more what I'm able and giving myself permission, making time for. I have, in terms of content, I've written the creatives piece. I've written a piece about the protest, specifically the experience, you know, capturing the experience of my daughter, who's 20 now, coming home after the Milwaukee Police Department fired rubber bullets and maced and gassed a peaceful protest. And what that experience was for her. And even in outside of the, so that first layer is the mama reaction. And then that next layer is also a mama reaction, but also someone who spent so many years working in youth development and leadership, that moment of comfort and pride that with my daughter and the young people I've worked with, I call them my sugar babies once they're out of high school. So my daughter and these sugar babies that are out here in the city, and literally in these streets, we are going to be fine. So I was able to, so that was a poem about that, those two layers of insight and emotion about who's on the front line and what's happening at that front line, and why this line even is even still here. So to be able to still in the space add weapons and tools and perspective into this urgent dialogue, it's also been really cool.
And it seems like building and connecting with new or emerging artists is important to you, that you care a lot about it. How have you been able to continue that work, and maybe how has it changed?
That hasn't been as easy, in that, so the newer and emerging, well, I take that back. So two things. One, going back to that, creating content while we were all initially bunkered in, one of the things that I wanted to offer was a space just for people to be creative. You're going to need that outlet. By and large, my writing courses and my workshops, yes, you're going to learn technique and craft, and we're going to talk about and jam in and talk about plot development, all that kind of good stuff. But really, I just want you thinking. Really, I just want to slip in this conversation about intersectionality. Really, we're just going to talk. We're going to have you're going to leave with this notebook full of more questions, hopefully, and ideas and starts, more so than you've been coached through writing a perfect essay. So being able to wanting to offer that just as a, hey, I'll be here on these days. I'm committed to making this happen. If you need it, come and get it. So I had a Saturday series that I offered for a few weeks, and then I had like a humanities kind of a shortened version of a course that I teach that I offered weekday on Wednesdays for a couple of months. So that felt great. You know, everyone's bringing what they have, hopefully, to the table. You know, I can take you for an hour and rejuvenate you, you know, through creative thinking and these questions and these prompts and meeting other folks. And then an hour you go back into the world and you've had this pick me up. You've had this excursion.
What has been the most challenging part of the pandemic for you as a writer, as a creator?
The most challenging part was the impotence. So as someone, you know, people who are planners, and that was what I realized I was making myself sick in trying to plan through something that had, where there's so many variables. But if that's how you're made, you plan a program, you plan a season, you plan how to release a thing, you plan how to gain a conversation or get into, you plan. So it's, you're always in relationship building, or you're nurturing relationships you already have. So that space, so that kind of, all of the different ways that we plan for what can come next, being prepared for what can come next, and having all of that stripped, really, was this, you know, this existential window of, you know, who am I? What am I doing? How am I? All of those questions I know everyone asks themselves at the beginning of this. So that was the hardest thing, because within that it was, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, it was a reckoning of this life that you've chosen, this way that you've constructed this work, and in the past not knowing was, well, let me build something that I do know, that I can reference or count on, or at least anchor myself to. You picture like swinging through monkey bars. You've got one bar, you know the next one will be there. All of that gone. All of that as a process gone. So I just felt unmoored.
And what has inspired you or given you hope during this challenging time?
On a couple of fronts. The first one would be going back to that front line. So witnessing these young leaders lead from the thousands of people who were able to be at marches because they're not able to be at their jobs. Being able to witness the air quotes unlikely leaders who, they didn't just start leading. They're just now in a position where they're refusing to be silent, and they're refusing to play along with the respectability politics, with the artificial groupthink of who should be out front. The people who care and have the capacity and have the network and the willingness and the fire, that's who needs to be out front right now. And that's who's out front right now. So that's been a joy to see. It's been encouraging to see more of my neighbors. And I mean this in a human way, in a citizenry way, actually be neighbors, right? So I, you know, thinking about the George Floyd and the racial unrest, I was able to I did attend a Mad Moms March. So I did I said some words and I shared a piece. And one of the things that I asked the group, you know, asked this gathering, I'm like, so here's the thing I want you to go back and continue talking about. What took you so long to be mad? This is the nth black man who's been murdered by a police officer. Why is this making you mad? And you weren't mad at the 50,000 ones that happened before just this year, right? And as I was leaving, there was a group of women there packing up the bourbon. She said, I really appreciated your comments. Your poem was really nice. And one woman, she looked at me and she said, over her mask, she says, what took me so long? I said, that's the question. And I want you to ask all your friends that, because that's where the work, that's where we're going to find the work is. Whatever the answer to my question is, that's where your work is. That's where all of our work is. So being in proximity to be able to actually make that statement to the group of strangers that I may never see again, but for whatever reason, they wouldn't have been present to hear that before. So that's been encouraging, but across the board, you know, people are still getting married. People are still, you know, applying for school. Folks are still taking drivers, you know, getting driver's licenses. Life is still happening. So those joys, those small ones, are also a welcome inspiration. That normalcy is not going to be familiar, but there will be a normalcy.
Dasha Kelly Hamilton is the Milwaukee Poet Laureate. She's a writer, performer, and creative change agent. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel as part of our series, Pandemic Performers. We'll take one last break, then hear an essay about the art of mindfulness. Lake Effect will continue in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now, I'm Joy Powers. Many of us have a lot on our minds right now. We're navigating a global pandemic, an election year, and adapting to working and learning from home. With everything going on, it's easy to get overwhelmed. But practicing mindfulness can help. Lake Effect contributor Barbara Miner found we can all learn something about being mindful from watching children.
I've always been intrigued by the practice of mindfulness and the art of living in the present. Over the years, I've bought books on mindfulness, listened to CDs, subscribed to podcasts, and always promised myself that I would be more mindful. But like many good intentions, it never seemed to stick. Sometimes it was my Catholic upbringing that got in the way, with its fondness for guilt over past sins. Sometimes it was just old-fashioned worrying about the future, even the ridiculous kind, like whether you should take that yoga class. Last fall, however, I had the good fortune to spend time with a mindfulness master. In classic Zen fashion, he never announced himself a master. He led by example. I was in Brooklyn for 3 months helping take care of my 4-month-old grandson River as my daughter returned to work. Her older child, 2.5-year-old Cashel, would be at daycare. New York schedules are crazy and the subways unpredictable, so I agreed to pick up Cashel from daycare. Around 4:30, I would put River in the stroller and we'd leave to get his brother. Cashel was too big to carry and so was expected to walk the half mile back home. I worried how to keep him distracted. We were all tired by that time of day, and I knew I wouldn't have my daughter's patience should a toddler tantrum erupt. I also knew that concepts of the past and the future don't mean much to a 2-year-old. It was meaningless to bribe Cashel with the promise of a cookie when we got home. I had to figure out how to keep him happy in the here and now. It ended up being less difficult than I feared. Toddlers, it turns out, are mindfulness masters. Their default is to live in the present. If they want a banana, they want it now. If they want to read a book, they want to read it now. And because they're constantly trying to figure out the world, they are acutely aware of their surroundings. I had become oblivious to many of the sights and sounds of New York. Not Cashel. He was the one, for instance, who noticed the nearby church bells that rang as we left daycare at 5 p.m. Taking cues from Cashel and building on his awareness of those bells, we developed a routine I came to treasure. We'd begin by counting the church bells. As we continued our walk, we'd count the planes flying overhead toward LaGuardia Airport, the number of city buses that drove by, or fire engines or trucks. We'd describe the colors of the sky as the sun set. As the days grew shorter and the sky darker, we'd look for the moon. At the time, I viewed a routine as a matter of survival. Looking back, I realize that I learned more about mindfulness during those walks than any book or podcast could ever teach. I think about Cashel and River a lot during this era of COVID-19. And not just because they are far away and I want to see them and hug them and know that everything is okay. Perhaps more than any time in my life, I feel little control over my future. The past, meanwhile, seems increasingly irrelevant. I remind myself to live in the present, and I think of Cashel and our walks home. My husband Bob and I live in a neighborhood where we can take walks while maintaining social distance. We have nowhere special to go and no need to hurry. In the spirit of Cashel, we try to be mindful. We stop and listen to the robins. We appreciate the daffodils and crocuses that are a harbinger of spring and, one hopes, the rebirth of life. Last week, we spent several minutes watching the garbage trucks as they picked up the containers in our neighborhood. I wish Cashel were with us, Bob said, echoing my thoughts. He would love following the garbage trucks. It would make his day.
Barbara Miner is a writer, photographer, and producer. You can find more of her work at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.